Okay, we're about to start part two, Mike Smith with James Rademacher, on November 16th, 2009, at Jim's house in Roanoke, Virginia. So we've spent a considerable amount of time this morning talking about your rise to a national office, and at this point in 1967, you are the vice president for the National Association of Letter Carriers. So what I'd really like to hear about now is how you got the presidency, the election and the campaign, and just how you became president, and start off with that.
Well, Mike, the president was Jerome Keating, and he decided in 1967 not to run for re-election. So I think we've discussed the proxy system, which I did not care for, because I wanted people to vote for me, not by proxy. It's always good to have 200,000 votes behind you, give you confidence. So I was elected by proxy because we saw to it nobody else ran. That was changed as soon as I took presidency. So the mood of the convention was like it has never been ever since 1889, even though our forefathers, letter carriers, were concerned about overtime and working 12 hours a day and so on. I still believe that the 1968 convention was one that's been the most noteworthy of all, because they came to that convention loaded for bear. And they had two resolutions that were the first two resolutions. One is to look into the feasibility of the right to strike. And the second was to eliminate from the civil service employment records a statement that every letter carrier had to sign that says, I hereby state that I will never assert the right to strike. Those are two resolutions. When I took my job as president in Washington in 1968, I immediately started to see if we couldn't get those resolutions approved. The right to strike was very difficult because it was a historic federal policy. But we immediately were able to win the elimination of that statement because you know very well, Mike, that the Constitution of this country allows you to assert anything you want to assert. So we knocked that out, and there was no appeal from the Civil Service Commission. So when we announced that, they thought that's the right to strike. But it wasn't. It means you no longer have to be stopped by asserting the right to strike, which I asserted in June of 1969 before Congress. And one congressman said, send for the sheriff. That was facetious on his part. I told the Congress very clearly, our members have reached a point that they can no longer sit still, that they're going to walk out any time, unless you do something about wages.
Now, this is 1969.
69 in June.
Right. And so tell me about the situation for letter carriers at that time. You've just stated that, you know, the letter carriers are going to walk out on their own. So what were the circumstances for letter carriers?
You had many letter carriers, Mike, with families who were receiving food stamps and welfare checks. Imagine carrying the mail, going visiting every home in this country, and knowing that you're receiving a food stamp or a welfare check. It's humiliating. Besides that, they were working two and even three jobs, and their wives were working. So there was no wonder that they were up in arms. And a comparison for you would be that a letter carrier's top salary was about $6,500 after 21 years. And a comparison would be the man that collected the trash in New York was $13,000 or $7,000 more than the letter carrier. So there's no wonder they're upset, and that's the way it was throughout most of the nation. So we got that one thing to taken care of the right to asserting the right to strike. But then the rest of it, we reached a point where we had every letter carrier calling in one station in New York, called in sick. They got suspended.
This was in 1969, sort of a pre-protest?
As we're heading towards the strike. This was the first sign of it. It was a strike by itself when they didn't show up on sick leave. So I had to settle that. And then I further warned Congress, something's got to be done. So then we put on a campaign that went into 400 cities. We had a ad made up to give each branch that said, "Save our service." It had a picture of a letter carrier holding out his hand. And on the letter he was holding out, it says, "SOS, save our service. Notify President Nixon right away to sign the pay bill." The White House got 3 million letters. And on December 5th of 1969, I got a phone call from the White House saying, "We'd like to discuss this with you. We got your message. When can you come over?" I said, "As soon as I hang up the phone." "Well, can we set it up tomorrow?" And I met with Charles Colson, who was the executive official with President Nixon. We went down the basement of the White House.
Is this the first time you've had contact?
And we went down the basement of the White House where there's a cafeteria. And they gave me lunch. And then he said, "Do you hear those footsteps?" And I said, "Yeah, I hear them." He said, "That's the president." I said, "Yeah, well, let me tell you, last year I was up there, not down here. President Johnson had me for dinner up there last year. Now let's go on from there." "Okay, well, let's start from scratch." So we went through the bill that was proposed by the Postal Commission to change, to reorganize the post office. And we reviewed it. He said, "What's your problem with it?" I said, "I want a labor management program that gives us the right. If you're going to deny us the right to strike, the alternative is binding arbitration. To me, you've saved money that way, and we're assured of an honest result of arbitration." He said, "Well, there's nothing wrong with that, so let's put that in the bill." We talked about a few other things, including maintaining civil service status, because our members were scared to death that they're going to be eliminated from civil service because they got pensions built up and everything else. He said, "That's easy. We can take that." So what I did, what nobody knew, I went to the Congress, to the halls of Congress, and I met with Congressman Udall, who was the vice chairman of the Post Office Committee, and told him everything that I learned at the White House. And he and I sat down and wrote the bill that was going to be presented from the result of my meeting. We didn't care what they did in the other areas of the regulations of mail service. That's their business. Our business is labor management. So each day I did that. And then I also went to the Senate committee chairman, Gail McGee of Wyoming. We sat down in a little place I didn't know existed in the Senate basement, little room down there. We sat in there in privacy. We went over it all, and they were ready. Then nothing happened, except other unions were very unhappy to know that I had a chance to go to the President of the United States.
Other unions such as?
The APW, there were 7 unions, mail handlers, truck drivers, maintenance workers. They were all unhappy. Who am I? So Colson gave in and invited him to the White House, but on a different floor than the president. They never got a chance to meet with the president. Well, Congress then stalled, and the chairman of the committee, Ted Dulski of Buffalo, New York, had a bill that he wanted to put in, which was different than the bill we agreed to at the White House. And there were 2 people that were unhappy about me meeting at the White House beside the unions. One was the Postmaster General. "How dare you go over my head to the president? And how dare the president talk to you?" Well, the answer was that when President Nixon asked me, why can't you discuss this with the Postmaster General? I said, Mr. President, I could if he'd ever meet with me. He'd been in office 2 years and refuses to meet with me. So he called him a few of his favorite expletive words, and we waited. And the second problem I had, besides the Postmaster General, was the chairman of the Post Office Committee, who wanted his own legislation for that credit. So we had problems there. I went to Buffalo to visit him and took care of him nicely, financially, and also with all the beer he wanted in his bathtub in a motel. Walked through 7 inches of snow at the airport of Buffalo. And he agreed with me that he would use the Nixon-Rademacher bill, which provided for postal reorganization, which provided for negotiations. When he got back to Washington, he changed his mind. So we had to go through that. So then things were getting worse. Nixon said that he was going to put a clamp on all price increases, all wage increases. And our members felt that.
Then the House across civil service.
Yeah, all the way across, yeah. So our members felt that, and I sent out a letter to every branch, and I said, we've reached a point where I'm going to have to make a decision. And I want to know that I have your support. 400 branches answered me. You've got our support. There's a few in our membership that are National Guardsmen that are afraid to death of strikes. But other than that, we got from 80% to 100% are willing to do whatever you want to do. So I get a letter similar to this, which is just coincidence, happens to be from South Bend, Indiana. We of Branch 338 have voted unanimously to support you in any action that you may deem necessary. I had 400 such letters and telegrams in my hand. I put out a weekly bulletin, said, cool it. You know, we're making progress. The House committee then voted on a bill that Udall and I had proposed earlier that allowed for a federal pay commission to discuss federal pay and go accordingly. I sent word to New York that that was happening. They got the same letter asking for my support. And people got up at the meeting, which later on the president of the branch and I said were the SDS group. Who were at that meeting, they took postal jobs, and they screamed out, strike, strike, that's not enough, strike, strike. Get carried away. So, Johnson, the heroic president from Branch 36, said, all right, we'll have a strike vote on the 17th, St. Patrick's Day. March lovely 17th. Day to have a vote. And they agreed to have the strike vote. But to me, that was a vote like the other branches took, that they would give me support. They didn't feel that way. They voted 1,500 to 1,000. Now bear this in mind. 2,500 votes were cast out of 8,000 members. It showed disinterest on the part of the rest of them. But it also showed 1,000 said no strike, right? So it was 3-2 in favor of a strike, and they think this is enough to walk out. And they walked out at midnight that night after the votes. Gus Johnson, the president of Branch 36, called me at home, and he said, they voted to strike by 3-2 margin. I said, let it blow. And when it went, everybody thought this was part of my deal, and they walked out. Now, 200,000 carriers around the country and other postal employees walked out and heard it by the radio in their post offices. They just thumbed their nose at the supervisors and walked out. They didn't care. Their job was at stake. They could go to jail. They didn't care because they reached this point of frustration. And I didn't tell you this, but when my father went from Ford Motor Company to the Postal Service, and my mother asked him why he did that. He said, for guaranteed security. And later on in life, my mother reminded him it was guaranteed poverty at what we had to live under. So that's what these carriers were living under. And I felt for them. I didn't know what to do. But on the other hand, when you're elected to serve, you either serve or get out.
Let me ask a couple things. So you've brought us to the point where the strike started. So I have several questions here, so I'll try to tackle them one at a time. One is, presidents of the letter carriers before you, did they have access to the President of the United States, or if not access, did they work with the President of the United States, or just the Postmaster General?
No, Bill Daugherty had access to John F. Kennedy. Mm-hmm. Jerome Keating was a very good friend of Lyndon Johnson's, but Lyndon Johnson gave Jerome Keating a heart attack because we were seeking a 5% pay raise, and Johnson called Keating over to his office and said, because of the budgetary conditions in the country, we used to be under the budget. It was different because some of the taxpayers' money went to subsidize the post office in those days, not anymore. So he told Keating, I can't give you more than 2%, and Keating had a heart attack right there.
Literally had a heart attack.
Yes, he did.
Right there.
Yeah. So that's the access we had to them. In 1952, when Eisenhower was running, he came to our convention in New York, and he said, Bill Daugherty, if you ever run into a problem, I will not have you sitting on my doorstep. You come right in and tell me the problem. When he got into office, he didn't recognize Daugherty at all, and he vetoed 4 pay raises of postal employees. That's how you could count on him. He was a great general, I don't deny that, but he was a poor postmaster general. And we took care of him in the 1954 convention when my people in Detroit carried a casket down Euclid Avenue in Cleveland that talked about the dead pay raise. And from that was another reason why they wanted to fire me. But as far as access, that's the total access that they had.
Your two predecessors had met with presidents to a certain degree, but it sounds like you had, because of the circumstances and
well,
the strike, you had...
Well, because 3 million, Mike, 3 million letters influenced Nixon. You better call this guy up.
Yeah.
Because people all over the country. And in fact, New York, to all their credit, New York said, you send in the coupon, we'll put the postage on. They spent thousands of dollars in postage out of the union money to send letters to Nixon. So it was a wonderful thing, and it was the greatest effort we ever made to do that.
So you're negotiating, and you let the members know you're negotiating, and ask for their support through the letter that you gave us an excerpt of one of them. So then, at this point, the strike starts out of Branch 36. Now, you've been talking with the president of Branch 36. But give me a perspective on sort of the role of Branch 36 or New York in the entire postal system. Because I want you, of course, to speak about the details of the strike, but it starts out in New York, sweeps the country spontaneously, which you've spoken to a little bit. So if you could give me a perspective on the power and role of Branch 36.
You could imagine. It went all over the radio while carriers are working in the morning because there was no mail in New York. And by 6 a.m. when carriers went to work, the radio was all over the country was saying they're on strike in New York. And the people that I had sent letters to thought this is their signal. And they went out. But immediately after New York went out, Hartford, Connecticut went out, Brooklyn, New York went out with them, and then sooner or later Detroit and San Francisco, Los Angeles, all over the country, except down south. Down south waited for me to officially say get out, so they did not go out. Nobody in the south went out. Mm-hmm. Now, when that happened, 7 o'clock the next morning, after the call of midnight, I told them, let it blow. Postmaster,
when you say let it blow, you meant let the strike go on?
Let it go, yeah, sure. Okay. Because the reset, what good would it do me to tell me to stop it?
But at this point, technically, it's not official.
No, it's not official, no.
It's a wildcat.
It's one of the few true wildcats. But when the Postmaster General called me in at 7 a.m. on March 18th, he told me this. I will, if you do not get those people back to work, I'll immediately discontinue the dues checkoff, which John F. Kennedy put in. On that subject, one before I go further.
Sure.
We used to have to go around collecting dues. And it was hard to do. When the President of the United States vetoes a pay bill, how do you collect money from people that are hurt by that?
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to do. But they maintained loyalty and faithfulness in the Union, but they suffered it four times during Eisenhower's administration. But when Kennedy went in, we got a dues checkoff. So the first thing he threatened me with, I'll immediately discontinue the dues checkoff. There'll be immediate discontinuance of the government share of health insurance. There'll be immediate discontinuance of life insurance. The federal government would abandon its participation in the civil service retirement program. The post office would use every means at its command to punish, fine, and imprison leaders of the walkout. NELC will no longer be recognized as a union. That's the threat I carried with me when I left the Postmaster General's office.
This
was a bluff.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it was. So I sent word.
At the time, did you believe it to be a bluff?
Oh, I looked very sincerely at him. Oh, yes, well, I understand what you're saying, you know. So I immediately sent a letter to New York. The post office was on strike, but I sent a letter to New York telling them to go back to work.
A letter that couldn't be delivered because of the strike. But you did your duty.
Yeah, sure. So then I called together branch leaders from 200 of the largest branches in the country to Washington.
How many branches were there at the time? Do you recall?
6,000.
6,000.
Yeah, but some of them had 5 or 6 members. They wouldn't come. They couldn't afford to come.
Sure.
But the 200 largest that represented 80% of the membership were there at the Continental Hotel in Washington, D.C. So it's scheduled for 11 a.m.
What day?
You get I think March, 2 days after the strike.
2 days, second day of the strike.
Yeah, that give them time to get there. And it was due to start at 11 to allow people from the East Coast to get into Washington in the morning. They didn't have to stay overnight. So at 11:05, I went in the closet to get my coat on, and my secretary said, the Secretary of Labor's on the phone. I said, oh, okay. Hello, Mr. Secretary, Mr. Schultz, George Schultz, Secretary of Labor. He said, we'd like to meet with you as soon as possible to try to settle whatever the problem is. I said, I'm sorry. I'm going to a meeting now to let you know what the problem is. And he said, well, can you let them know that we're ready to sit down? I said, I'll tell them. I got on my coat, went to the meeting. I got up before them, and I said, in this hand, I've got 400 letters and telegrams telling me they'll support whatever action I take. In this hand, I got a message from the Secretary of Labor. I won't tell you this. A man in the audience got up and said, I move we give you 5 days to settle this. We'll go back to work. It was almost unanimous because they didn't want to stay out, but they trusted me that I was going to do something. So I left that meeting and told him I'll be back at 1 o'clock. I went over to see Schultz. He set up the motions for a meeting the very next day, Saturday. I went back to the meeting and I said, this is it. You got 5 days, and we'll have to have an answer. Well, I didn't negotiate on Good Friday. I refused to negotiate on Easter. It went beyond 5 days, and they were stalling, so I put out this message. I'd give this message to the people on the other side of the fence and also to my membership. This is addressed to my fellow Americans. I sadly report to you that negotiations, which we were led to believe, would lead to a prompt and substantial alleviation of the pathetic plight of postal workers, has been ended in miserable failure. Instead of a wage increase retroactive to October of 69, which according to the government's own statistics is minimum necessary to enable postal workers to keep pace with the cost of living and provide decent level of subsistence for their families. The administration's final offer was a total of 6%, retroactive to January. Accordingly, I call upon all postal employees as of next Monday, April 6th, to petition Congress and American public for a redress of their grievances instead of delivery mail addressed to their congressmen. On that day, postal workers will demonstrate their solidarity and determination to obtain justice. There will be no picketing of federal buildings, no parades, no displays, only the customary service of postal employees will be lacking. Our demonstration will be accomplished with the utmost concern for needs of pensioners, the poor, the ill, and our servicemen overseas. Compassionate mail can and should be delivered by our members on their own time, with agreement with postmasters. Each and every local union will meet on that day and on succeeding days to draft and send appropriate resolution to their congressmen and senators and to the press. In the meantime, each and every postal worker will visit available congressmen in person at home. Service will be resumed when you, the American public, so will it. I didn't have to issue that because when they saw that, we sat down and said, let's get it over with.
Mm-hmm. When you say they saw it, you're talking about the
Secretary of Labor.
Right. Now, what was the Secretary of Labor's role in this? Because you're dealing with the Postmaster General. That's who you negotiate with. Yeah. And there's the commission. So what was the Secretary of Labor's role jumping into this?
Nixon didn't want, his name was Winton Blunt. He's an anti-union contractor from Alabama.
This was the Postmaster General.
And he never met with me for 2 years. And Nixon didn't want him involved because he knew what would happen. Threatening, get back to work or go to jail. Because, you know, we don't want that. We want to sit down and talk. So Nixon assigned Schultz to it and said, keep the Postmaster General out of it. So we sat down and talked about, first of all, we did not accept reorganization, as Nixon and I agreed. We only wanted a pay raise. Nixon waited patiently, and then finally he said, I'm going to have to order the Army in. I said, give me one more night. It's in the history books of the Army. I've read it in their report. It says they held up in New Jersey because of the request of the president of the letter carriers union, hoping that they'd go back to work. They didn't go back to work. So the National Guard went in to deliver mail. They didn't know how. In due respect to them, they just couldn't case and deliver. So that fizzled. But New York would not go back. But because everybody else did, they gave in and met with me and the other leaders. Then Meany got upset because I was on TV all the time, and he sent James Gilday, his assistant, to the meeting, and we went to have the meeting, and Gilday got up and said, you are off TV. I said, who are you? And he told me, and I said, doesn't make any difference. This is a letter carrier strike, and then we're going to settle it ourselves. If you want to assist us, we welcome all the assistance we can get. But I'm not getting off TV. I'm telling the public our story. So he settled down, and then we got together as to what we're going to do. Well, then it came to the fact that they were going to get a 6% pay raise to all federal employees who didn't strike. I said, that's not fair. So they said, how about buying postal reorganization for cash? And I said, well, let's talk about it. Well, we'll give you additional 6%. And Meany said, how does that sound? George Meany, head of the AFL, how does that sound? And I said, it doesn't sound good. Well, why doesn't it sound good? It's better than nothing. I said, it doesn't sound good because it sounds too close to 6% you gave those other federal employees. We got to have at least 8. Okay. So we bought reorganization, which was what I was fighting for years, where I opposed it constantly because I said, we're not going to give them this for nothing. So we got 8% in addition to 6%, which is 14%. But in addition to that, they agreed that no longer would a letter carrier have to go 21 years. We could do it in 8.
To go from the lowest rate to the top rate.
That's right. Can you imagine waiting 21 years? You're almost ready to retire, and you're finally getting the top step. Ridiculous. So Nixon agreed to that, and they agreed in meeting. So we go back then to the Nixon meeting, which agreed, that's the reorganization plan that included real labor-management relations, and it even included the Taft-Hartley Act and so on, which allowed the union shop if Congress approved of it. And that's when we had interference from the field telling people, telling congressmen, we don't want it, so we lost it. We don't need it because our union is powerful. We got 93%. Voluntary unionism, there's no other union like it in the country. So that...
That was the counter-argument.
Yeah. Now then, we agree on April 6th. The strike was March 17th. We agreed on April 6th in front of Meany that we would accept it. We went to the White House, sat around a big table with Nixon, all the union leaders and labor leaders, congressmen, and all, sat around there and reached agreement, notified the press, notified Congress, we reached agreement. Then we waited. Nothing happened. People in New York said they're ready to go out again. Gus Johnson, despite his friendship to me, brought a group down to Washington on May 15th to strike again. I said, you do it and you're expelled from the union. That's all. So they couldn't get any votes for another strike because they knew we were doing the best we could do. So because of this anxiety on the part of especially New Yorkers, I went to Congressman Arnold Olson, a good friend on the committee. He's from Montana. He was a good friend we had on the post office committee. And I said, I don't want another strike. You don't want another strike. Do me a favor. Put a resolution before your committee to make it retroactive to April 6th, no matter when we get it. He said, I can do that. He does it. And what do you think happened? You wouldn't believe what happened. George Meany wrote a letter to every member of Congress telling him not to vote for the retroactive pay because he was a member of the committee that agreed to the contract. When we went to the Hawaii Convention the same year, there was a motion on the floor to get out of the AFL-CIO. I fought it. I said, don't take it. It's because one man did what he thought was right. I said, I don't agree with him, but he had principle, but we needed the money. So I said, don't. It barely lost the motion. Barely lost. We almost pulled out. So I had Meany come over and address the Board of Officers later on to settle things down. It was a bad thing for him to do, but Congress didn't pay attention to him. They paid attention to us, that if they didn't give us retroactive aid, they would walk out again because we're not afraid. So we'll go back 1 minute to what Walter Reuther told me after a veto by Eisenhower. I was on the plane going back from Washington to Detroit, and Reuther was sitting beside me. And he said, you look depressed. I said, I am. We've suffered the fourth veto of the pay raise. He said, I'll tell you your problem. You've got to unionize your association. I said, I never thought of that. Well, it took from 1954 to 1970 to unionize it, but we're unionized now. We got a grievance procedure. We got collective bargaining, not collective begging. We've got a strong union behind us. We've got respect at the bargaining table, and we're far away from the $5,500 I promised Detroit in 1950.
How did Meany get involved in the first place? Because all of a sudden he appears.
Because all seven unions involved were members of the AFL-CIO, mm-hmm. and he felt they needed a spokesman. Now, besides Gilday, who incidentally, as soon as this was over, accepted the job as assistant postmaster general, which smelled to me.
Mm-hmm.
But Meany got involved because he represented the seven unions. I didn't mind. He got in at the end, that's all, to make sure everything was okay. But he shouldn't have sent the letter, but he did.
And it sounds like he was somewhat jealous of just that you had a moment in the spotlight.
Well, the press turned to me because it was letter carriers on strike.
Right, but Meany didn't like that.
No, for instance, you mentioned, we have mentioned Mo Biller once.
Mm-hmm.
Mo Biller had some of his people in California go on strike on Saturday and come back on Monday. Great strike, right? But we were the people behind it, and the other union leaders just tore me apart for allowing it to happen. I said, it didn't happen. Congress and the president and the situation has existed to let it happen. It's been happening for years. We've been under poverty, and now we finally have won something, and they won it with us.
Mm-hmm.
And they did very little to gain it. But I think the best stroke was the 8% for buying postal reorganization, which we benefit from by having collective bargaining. See?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying I'm shrewd, but I'm saying it was a method of my madness from the very beginning.
Well, it was shrewd.
I opposed reorganization constantly for very many reasons. One of the most foolish I ever give was just a statement to Congress that the AT&T would take over the post office once they're reorganized in a corporation form. One thing I did at the White House, they were going to call it a corporation. We changed it to U.S. Postal Service. We didn't want a corporation.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, that's the story of the strike. We were successful, and today letter carriers are benefiting.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, first thing we did, immediately after this, we got the law passed that letter carrier would reach the top step in 8 years. That was the first thing. That was November. Then we met in July of the following year, of 71, for the first contract.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little brief story to that. We had reached a stalemate. We didn't want to go to mediation. We didn't want to go to arbitration. We wanted to prove we could settle it between ourselves. But there was nothing happening. It was my birthday, July 18th, 1971. A knock came on the door. I opened the door, and it was Bill Usry's assistant. Bill Usry was Secretary of Labor. Mm-hmm. After Schultz. He was a big help to us as a mediator. And it was his assistant, and he said, the secretary sent you a gift for your birthday. It was a box. I don't know if you've seen it before, but it was a lot of laughter. You open it up, you squeeze it, and people are laughing hilariously. I opened it up, and it was hysterical. Everybody got it just in tears laughing. And finally, the head of the negotiating team for the Postal Service says, what the hell? Let's get this thing over with. What do you want? And we said, we wanted $1,500 pay raise. Okay, let's get the thing over with. On my birthday, and we settled it. Because at midnight, we were going to mediation.
Mm-hmm.
It was about 1 o'clock in the morning. We set the clock back. We laughed on the box. We settled it that night because of that little thing. That's another good story.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, then you said that, you know, you would oppose reorganization?
I opposed it from the very beginning
because
on the labor management end of it, the first part of it, I didn't care. I didn't care what they do about rates or serve, whatever they want to do, but I cared about management relations. And the way the original bill was written, they provided that the Postmaster General shall appoint a committee of three who will decide grievances. I want none of that. None of that at all.
Mm-hmm.
So that I worked out at the White House. That changed it. So
you opposed it?
I opposed it, and there was a big headline in the newspaper. Mr. Rademacher, see the wisdom of reorganization. Big headline in the Detroit paper.
This was after the strike. The
Washington paper.
Just after the strike or before?
Before the strike.
Before the strike.
They kept after me all the time, offering me. Another thing is this, psychological. I don't want any credit for anything. I'm there as president, and I want to do what was necessary. But the post office wanted this badly. It started when the Postmaster General, Larry O'Brien, said there's no overtime at Christmas. That's ridiculous.
When? When did he say that?
1966. So the mail piled up. So then he comes to Congress and says, we're having a lot of trouble. We got to reorganize the post office. But he caused it. So we fought it in 66, 67, 68, and Lyndon Johnson put it in first, and then Nixon put it in second. The same thing, same language. And then we opposed it constantly. Keating opposed it. I opposed it because we didn't like what they were going to do to labor management.
So you're opposing the Postmaster General congressional generated reform, yet you would have liked to seen reform right along.
I wanted reform, but not that kind.
Yeah.
It eliminated the Postmaster General from the cabinet, used to be in the cabinet. It eliminated subsidies. The post office could control its own cash reserves, cash money.
This is the new postal service.
Everything was fine. It needed reorganization, but all I cared about was the labor management part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Until they treated our people properly, I wanted no part of it. And I was the strongest voice mm-hmm. in Congress about it. And we had a vote. The best vote we got was 17-6 against it because mm-hmm. of us. Suddenly it becomes 15-11. And I'm getting nervous because the Postmaster General was building post offices in cities of the congressmen on the committee. Mm-hmm. I couldn't do that. I couldn't offer even the dinner to them. We couldn't afford it.
Mm-hmm.
But he offered them a post office, and we lost several votes, and you'll find post offices around the country with the names on that he put up to get votes. So we got to 15-11, I'm getting nervous. The final vote before I met with Nixon was 17, was a tie vote, 13-13. As this is it. We got to move or get off the pot. You know, this is terrible. Because they're buying this reorganization, and they're going to show us. So I was eager to get paid for reorganization and to settle it before they settle it for us. And that's the way it ended.
Mm-hmm.
But we got our labor management with binding arbitration in lieu of a strike vote,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which is the best, I think.
So the strike worked to the letter carrier's benefit, in your opinion?
Oh, no question about it.
Yeah.
But the reorganization did not result as a part of the strike. It resulted as part of our negotiations.
After the strike.
Because it's my own fault. I had taught our membership, we do not want any part of this reorganization. And that's why they were mad at me when I come out of the White House and I put out a bulletin that these things are going to be in the reorganization. Wait a minute. We didn't tell you to do that. So I got in a lot of trouble. And a lot of nasty things were said at the time about me. But sometimes you have to work secretly and privately to gain the benefits of the people you represent. And I did. Took the flak for it, but mm-hmm. look at them now.
Mm-hmm.
$55,000.
Mm-hmm.
You know what that means down south? That's another thing we have fought for years, is pay raises according to area.
Mm-hmm.
We do agree that Hawaii and Alaska get a 15% benefit because it's cost mm-hmm. of living. But our argument has been the mail sack has been just as heavy in Atlanta, Georgia, as it is in New York City. That's not a very sound argument when it comes to money.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, everybody's satisfied now. Mm-hmm. Nobody's complaining. Nobody wanting to strike. They're mm-hmm. very happy. The two things that I put in the bill immediately, put into the contract immediately to settle things down. One was a cost of living allowance. One of the reasons we were so poorly paid and received such low wages is the cost of living had soared and we did not benefit from it, so we needed a cost of living. And the second thing I put in there was a no layoff. But I didn't do it because of what's happening today. I did it because our members were fearful they will no longer be in civil service. And so we have two clauses in there today that there will be no layoff of any employee. And an arbitrator upset that. And I'm very unhappy they didn't appeal the arbitrator's decision because he had no right. The President of the United States declared that after 8 years you get in top pay. The arbitrator ruled after 12 years. I don't think he had any right to do that. But he did it in 1982.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have 6 years of service now. So now, post office hands are tied. They can't lay off anybody more than 6 years, and there's nothing they can do about it, unless they want to go to court.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, as I told you before, putting in that cost of living allowance, they put a cap on it of $166 the first year. Second year, we removed the cap. And now, as I told you, $18,000 since mm-hmm. the start of this 1971 till now, $18,000 of the $55,000 is because of COLA.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really something.
Mm-hmm.
They'd have been without it. Myself, when I retired, my civil service pension was $700 a month. Because of COLA, today it's $2,700 a month. $2,000 a month, a month increase.
Mm.
We never got $2,000 a month in 20 years. The other thing that has resulted from this, from 1925 to 1943, we realized zero pay raises. From 43 to 70, we averaged $300 a year pay raises. Since the contract, we've never gotten less than $1,000 a year pay raises. That tells you something. Now, another thing that we can't overlook is part of the contract provided in the first place, the government would pay half of our health insurance. The rest of the federal employees benefited because once we got it, they got it. So we did better. The next year, the next contract, I asked for 75%. We got that. The life insurance is free. We don't pay for that. So all those things have come along. And the new man today got a nice job, nice pay. He doesn't understand, where did this come from? The sweat and tears of the past, where did it come from? We would have rallies in Washington. Congress would come there and say, you need 10%. You are going to support 15%. The Bureau of the Budget sends them a letter and says, we're not going to pay more than 3%. So what do? We had one, to give you a little humor, one conference in Washington where we were asking for a 5% increase. And Congress were coming there saying, we're going to give you more than that and all that. So we adjourned for the luncheon period. And we always announce the caucuses that follow, that word caucus coming. The Illinois delegates will caucus at the Statler Hotel. New York delegates will be at the Sheraton Hotel and so on. The little guy stands up and says, the two delegates from Utah will meet in the phone booth across the street.
That's pretty good. Yeah.
Now we've come a long ways, I'll tell you. And the strike put us on the map, not only with the membership, but with our fellow trade unionists, that we're a union now. Walter Ruther would be proud of me, proud of the NALC, that we're a union at last. And
so you were president another 7 years.
Yeah.
So obviously, as you've just described in good detail, the strike was a pivotal moment for the Association of Letter Carriers itself, and in pivotal in terms of contract, in terms of being a real union, as you put it. So how did this affect your job as president in the next 7 years?
Well, there were always the people that find fault with the contract. But what has been overlooked even till today is that the threats that were made if I didn't call the people back to work and if they didn't go back to work, all those threats.
From the threats coming from
the federal, Postmaster General.
From the Postmaster General.
Not from the President, but the Postmaster General. None of them happened. They handed out a paper for us to fill out that they, we will agree to a meeting to determine the punishment, the discipline that will be metered out when this is over. I tore it up right in front of them. I'm not agreeing to any punishment. And I talked to Colson to get to Nixon, and Nixon agreed, even when I was with him there, that certainly those low pays with the people that face the American public every day it's reasonable. He said he didn't support a strike, but it's reasonable that we do something about it. And he said, I'm not going to give anybody discipline. And out of the entire membership, one person was penalized and disciplined. He was told by a judge in Hartford, Connecticut, the president of the branch at that time, don't you dare go back on that picket line. And he went back. They took his picture, showed it to the judge, and he got fined $2,500. I wanted to pay that money privately. The judge ordered it's coming out of your pocket. My lawyer said, don't get involved in it for your own sake. So we didn't do it. I'm sorry we didn't do it. So take up a collection or something, because he's the only one out of all the thousands that struck that was disciplined that way. Mm-hmm. And I credit Nixon for that. I know that, you know, a lot of people feel differently about Nixon, but in my working with him, he was very reasonable. When you stop to think of this, and I'm sure the union people think of this, for what he did for us there in that agreement, and even seeing me, and then after seeing me had the people strike against him. Compare that with Ronald Reagan, what he did when he fired 12,000 air controllers because he gave them so much time to walk, get back to work, and they didn't do it, and he took 12,000 jobs away. Compare that with Nixon's treatment of me, mm-hmm. and you can see, whether or not you agree with Nixon, that it was pretty fair of him, what he did, mm-hmm. and I appreciated that, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, what do I do the next 7 years? We've got an excellent contract, and that's another thing that's not understood. As we sat down from scratch and wrote 36 articles to start this Postal Service, 36 articles that they had to sign, and start from scratch. That's what took so long. And as I said, it hasn't been changed since, except the pay raise figures that are in there. There's a lot of memorandums of understanding, mm-hmm. because things do happen that you don't expect in the when you write a contract.
Mm-hmm.
But the original language is still there. Mm-hmm. But then every 2 years, I had to prepare for the next negotiations. And what do we do? What, you know, what do we need? What's the next thing, you know? And I tried something that I mentioned at the convention that today's Postal Record shows. Man's quoted, no, another paper there quotes me at this late date. But I wanted to get in a contract that a supervisor responsible for a grievance that the arbitrator overrules should pay for that grievance. Then it wouldn't happen, because the grievances are so petty today. It's unbelievable. And the UAW may have had a major grievance, but they don't have the grievances we have today. Overtime. We've got grievances right now which are totally illegal, and the people doing it could even go to jail. Supervisors are erasing overtime, rightfully earned by employees today. Now
they're racing it?
They're racing it. So there's a case in New Hampshire right now. They're going to get all that money back with interest. Back before I retired, some letter carriers in California were working more than 8 hours a day. They'd come in and ring the time card. The supervisor would race it and put down the 8-hour ending time. We took it to next level up. Finally got into arbitration. The arbitrator said, everybody in this country who finds a time card erased will get money. So rather than try to find out who they were, the post office gave everybody that applied for it millions of dollars. I don't know how much, $6 million may be involved because of that.
Hmm.
That's what the grievance procedure we won did. Without a grievance procedure, what do you got?
Yeah.
Hand-picked people decide the fate.
Yeah.
So that's where we are on the strike, and you can see the value of it.
Yeah. Well, what'd you do with the rest of your 7 years?
Well, every 2 years it was a negotiation.
Right.
And then, again, my own problem of trying to do everything myself, including the postal record, as president of all things. I had a lot of grievances. I had going on what was called a pre-arbitration meeting with a certain member of management. And I'd go over there once a week. And I'd take some of the worst grievances we got and try to resolve them. Some I lost because it had no merit whatsoever. Others I won. They put people back to work. But people that were involved in fighting with patrons or stealing the mail, I couldn't support that. No way. Mm-hmm. So that's what I did a lot of my time. Mm-hmm. And then we have meetings. I was on the first council that was established by the Postal Reorganization Act. It was a council of 11 people, which included union officials. I was on that. Then after I retired, I was on the Postal Service Commission as the vice chairman, mm-hmm. a committee of 7 people. We went all over the country finding out what's the mail service like. So that took some time. But during my 7 years, there was a lot to be done to make sure everybody copes with that contract, because it's new to everybody, both sides. Mm-hmm. And our local people had to then negotiate local contracts. Mm-hmm. And we had to observe and watch over that, mm-hmm. Make sure that they get everything they get entitled to. Mm-hmm. But, you know, to me, it's not because I'm involved in it, but because it was the greatest, most accomplished thing since our 1889 history. Mm-hmm. The strike and the results. Mm-hmm. Again, the people did not strike for reorganization because I had put up such a fight against it. Mm-hmm. Then why are you supporting it? I had to tell them why. Mm-hmm. And the average guy who doesn't get into trouble doesn't understand why I would want a labor management program. Mm-hmm. What do you care about? I don't get in any trouble. No, but a lot of people do. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Not only that, but there's a word, respect. When that station steward goes before a supervisor, there's got to be some respect shown. And that respect is the contract. That's it. Mm-hmm. And if he violates the respect of the contract, then we have a way of handling it, doing business mm-hmm. with it. So that makes a long story short.
Well, I've got a couple other questions here. One is, during the strike itself, you had mentioned something to me about a bomb.
Yeah.
Yeah, which, well, tell the story. It's pretty interesting.
After the strike began, I was bombarded with telegrams and personal letters threatening my life. I had a bodyguard for the whole time of the negotiations. Some of them even threatened my family. My wife was in the hospital as a result of that. I lived in a motel as a result of that. Nobody knew my number. Except my wife.
That's your wife was in the hospital?
She was, yes.
Affected her?
Yeah. And her nerves couldn't take it. She didn't know about the threats, but just, mm-hmm. she knew what was going on. So I had a private room in a hotel, which only the top officers knew if they had to get a hold of me that night. Now, what happened there, the threats were not just by the membership, even though I was hung in effigy at Times Square, New York. And I made them all the madder when I said you could have at least put hair on that effigy. they didn't appreciate that. But the reason they were mad at me is I didn't lead them. If I'd have led them, this would have happened, what I told you. The 10 items the Postmaster General gave me, that's what would have happened. And he's that vicious of a person.
They would have been put in place.
Absolutely. At least one or two would start taking place. So I let them hate me and did the best I could. Mm-hmm. When I went in there to explain the contract, they started throwing chairs up there, and Sombrato had to, he was president then, he had to
stop them. This is at Branch 36
in New York City. He had to stop them from attacking me, and I had 3 great men, 6'5" or more, leading me on the way back to the railroad station, back to Washington. A big package arrived at my office, and it had no postage on it. Well, in view of the threats that were made, I started worrying. Well, the Army was within 10 minutes of my office there in Washington. I called the Army bomb squad. They came in there with the minutes they were